Thank you guys so much for joining us. I'm so sorry that we're a little late, but we're just trying to get everything organized. I decided to host this panel because this is a core value for me as a Black woman, as a therapist, just to share a little story about myself so you understand my perspective and why human rights and mental health wellness is so important to me. I actually was born into a military army family. And right before I was born, my family was recently, was stationed actually in Seattle, Washington. And this is back in the 70s. And back in the 70s, when my family was stationed there, we lived in an all-white neighborhood. And my family was receiving a lot of bomb threats and death threats because of the color of their skin. They were the only Black family in the area. And actually, another white family hosted us and protected us until my mom could have me. And so from that situation, I've always known and experienced racism, but I've always known and experienced human compassion and human kindness from people of all races. And I think that has really benefited my mental health. Thus today, I'm so honored on my panel today to also have fellow therapists with me, and there's gonna be a variety that have come in and out, who on a daily basis show human compassion and kindness and respecting human rights in their personal lives and in their professional lives. And they believe that respecting human rights, of course, as we all do, benefits mental health wellness, which is what we all aim for. So I first would like to introduce a young lady. And her name's Marie, and I would like to introduce her. She's a fantastic therapist. And Marie, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and maybe your first experience in dealing with racism and human compassion?
Absolutely. Good afternoon to all of you who are on the panel and to all of you who may be watching live on Facebook or will be viewing this at a later time. I salute you this afternoon for taking the time to discuss or to listen on a very important topic. So my name is Marie Ovensi. I migrated here at the age of 15, came from Haiti to here. When I came here, I studied middle school in Orlando, and I was in the eighth grade. And not speaking the language, not able to understand or even understanding the culture, the American culture, it was quite hard. But, other people always said to me, other adults that were Haitian always said to me, oh, don't worry, you will speak the language, you will be okay. One day you will write a whole essay all on your own. And I could not believe it. I was always telling myself, this is unbelievable. This is not going to be able to happen. Now, let me take a step back prior to coming in here. I was born in Haiti, raised by my mother and my grandmother. Now, my father had already migrated in another island in searching for a better life. While he was navigating through that, I was raised by my mother and my grandmother. So I was not raised with a father figure in my life. It was a struggle growing up. So when I came in here, started school, my whole forefront was, I'm going to be the best that I can no matter what. To answer the question. Dr. April, to answer the question, when I faced my first time that I was going to start on my AA degree, at that time, I was working a security job. It was a 3-day security job. I was working in the evening so I could go to school in the morning. While I was studying, because it was not busy while I was at the gate, so I bought my books to study while I was on the job. And somebody else, an elderly, he probably was about 65 years old, retired, but continued working. He told me, and I remember this like it was yesterday, he asked me, he said, what are you going to school for? And I said, I want to become a teacher. He said, becoming a teacher? What do you mean? I said, I'm going to school to become a teacher. He said, well, you cannot. I said, why not? He said, because my granddaughter is studying to becoming a teacher. I don't think you're capable to become a teacher. Yeah. And I said, and then he proceeded to ask me, do you even have a high school diploma? And I asked him, I said, do you think I will start college without a high school diploma? Uh-huh. And that's where the conversation stopped. At that time, I was really upset. I couldn't understand why he had compared me to if his granddaughter was going to school to get a degree to become a teacher that I couldn't. So I was really upset. Now, a part of me wanted to retaliate it, which I a little bit did. But another part of me actually believed, because he's white, his granddaughter is white. Maybe I'm not on the same. I told you, learning the English language was hard for me. So I'm sitting there thinking, oh my gosh, is it because of my accent that he said that? Is it because that I'm black and Haitian on top of it? Is it because that my hair is not wavy or long? Why did he say that? So I struggled a lot with that. Even mm-hmm. after I graduated with my bachelor degree in education at FGCU, that was still on my forefront. Like, how did I make it? Was that even possible? How did that happen? I actually was able to fight that while I was in graduate school. So that's when I faced it. And sometimes it's just a single statement that could hurt someone for the rest of their lives.
Right. It's a microaggression statement. Yes, definitely. Yeah. Yes. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story. All right. Also on our panel, we have a wonderful young lady, Dr. Kelly Boucher. So yes, Dr. Kelly Boucher, please let us know about some information about you and when you experience any type of racism, and also about human compassion.
It's great to be here. And with such a wonderful group of people, truly. And I liked how you began this, April, by saying that the people that within the group on the panel are compassionate, because I have really observed that and those strengths. And I've learned so much from all of you and your empathy. And empathy is different than sympathy, of course. So I can sympathize to some degree. But as far as empathy and racism, I cannot. I have experienced very mildly when I first began working with Native Americans. I would go, and by the way, I've worked with them for 27 years, and I've been to over 50 Indian reservations, and just been privileged to work with Native American youth for over two decades. But when I first went, I mean, I didn't even work on my tan. Now I work on my tan before I go so I can blend a little bit better. And one time I showed up and I was still fair skinned, even though I tan quite well. And I dyed my hair blonde, and I had short blonde hair and green eyes. And that was the first time. And my friend had said, why did you do that? And I just wasn't thinking. But the thing is that was the very first time that I had kind of experienced some form of, I wouldn't even say racism, they just treated me different, but I was different, you know? And so it's just a very mild thing where I went, wow, I'm different. And I never really felt that before. In fact, I grew up in Northern Michigan, and I was 5 hours north of Detroit. And I did not even see my first African-American until I was 14 years old. So I lived in a very, very Caucasian community. I can't speak from that end, but I can say that I sympathize with you, and my heart is grieving over what is happening in our world today. But also what has happened in our world before, but was never truly addressed. And hopefully we'll be able to address it now.
Well, thank you so much for being on the panel. Yes. Okay, awesome. We also have Dr. David Hall on the panel. Welcome, Dr. David. Hi, for some reason I can't hear you. Can you unmute yourself?
Hello.
Hello, yes, welcome. Yes. So please tell us, I still can't hear you.
Hello?
Yes.
You hear me now?
I can hear you now, yes. Yes. Thanks for being on the panel. Please tell us reason about your background and why you decided to be on this panel today and any experience with racism and stuff.
Yeah. Actually, I'd like to address what my first encounter with racism, and it's interesting. I grew up in New England, and like Kelly just said, you know, I grew up in a town with no Black people in the town. And, or I think I lived in New Hampshire. I think we might have had, I don't know, 150 Blacks in the entire state when I was in high school, way back in the 60s. And I had never heard of racism. I didn't know it existed. And I used to hang out downtown with my buds and my friends in a very small town. And we grew apples. And in the fall, they would hire a group of migrant workers who would pick apples. And these men were mainly Jamaican.
Okay.
Jamaican Blacks.
Uh-huh.
And they would come down to the local store in the evening to buy a bottle of beer or, you know, something. And the people I was with, the fellow students with me, started using racial slurs and calling them names, and not to their, I don't think to their faces, but they'd say those and whatever they said. And I said, what does that word mean? What does that word mean? Why do you call them that? And I did not understand what they were saying, what they meant by it, what the words meant, what the attitudes were. I could see they were negative attitudes or disdain. And I did not, I said, why do you say that? I don't get it. Explain this to me. And it's interesting because later I was in Haiti on a mission, and more than half our team was Black. And they were sitting around talking about their first exposure to racism. They were American. One guy was Nigerian, but has lived in the US for 20 years, 30 years. And they were talking about their first experiences with racism. And I overheard the conversation, and I didn't even think, it didn't occur to me that I have no idea what it's like to be the object of racism. Mm-hmm. And I just heard them talking about their first experience. And I remember how confusing it was for me the first time that I saw it happening from whites towards Blacks. And so I piped up. And they just looked at me like, you're crazy. like my story about my confusion at seeing it, I still think that's a significant story.
Right, definitely.
Because it was just confusing for me to see it. I never understood it. And but then I had experience with racism when I was in Haiti. And we had seven white guys in the back of a truck, and it was gonna rain. So the guy who was helping us, the Haitian man who was helping us, he said, take your shirts off, put them in your backpack, because we're gonna go through a rainstorm. And when we get out of the rainstorm, you'll have a dry shirt. You can put them back on. So seven white guys in the back of a pickup truck traveling through small towns in Haiti. And all the kids go, blah, blah, blah. I mean, white, a whole truck full of white men, and our shirts off, really ugly. And the thing is that was, in a sense, it was racism, because they're going, white people, but there was no hatred. There was no disdain. It was almost like, oh my gosh, look at, this is great. Look at this, with these white people, like they're excited. It was almost a celebration as we went down. It was like seeing, here in New Hampshire, I might see a bald eagle. Like, here's something unusual that you don't see every day. And so is none of the negativity, none of the hatred and the disdain that comes with, you know.
Right. And that's what makes racism so bad, because you have to have that hatred, the disdain,
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story. Yes. And our last person that we have so far on our panel right now, but one of a very fantastic therapist down in Naples, Florida, is Michael. Okay, yes, Michael, I can't hear you. Oh, I have to accent mute.
There we go.
Yes, yes, yes. Good. So welcome to be on this panel, Michael.
Sorry I'm late.
Oh, that's okay, that's right. Yeah. Well, let us know about your story.
So I'm taking this a little bit more from a more overtly political point of view, because that was my background. And I guess that's where my story connects with what we're talking about, right? So The first half of my adult career was in political science. I did bachelor's and master's in political science. And so, you know, we studied these things from a governmental, political, public policy viewpoint. So, you know, when I hear in the media or even from friends of friends, acquaintances, et cetera, that there is no racism or it doesn't exist, that's where I sort of get stuck, because it's so obvious to either people of color or people who've studied this that, you know, it sounds a bit ridiculous, to be honest, to hear that it doesn't exist. But I hear that pretty regularly, and I'm sure we all do, right? We put on the TV and we say, well, there's no such thing. And even within my own circle, I've heard it like in passing, like on Facebook, like, oh, we know that this is all BS. It doesn't exist. So, you know, it's like, what do we do? I mean, once upon a time, it was sort of more overt. So you can formulate policies to make it better, et cetera. But what do you do when people are denying its existence? That adds a whole nother level. And that's about power. That's racism in and of itself. The fact that the discourse can be defined as it not even existing. So very troubling that we've gone from, and I remember in my master's program in political science, I was thinking that things were better, not better meaning fixed, but better than they had been. And it was funny because some of the Black master students were shaking their heads and saying they feel that it's worse. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, like, how is that even possible, right? I've studied the movements. I knew that side of it. But there's this undercurrent of feeling that there's certain aspects about race now that are worse than pre-civil rights era because of that insidious nature of asserting that it doesn't exist, right? Because how do you fight something that doesn't, you don't even have the beginning point. So they were saying how they feel that it's worse because claims about it are just kind of like swept aside. So I think it's a real challenge for this to not bother you on an individual level and not affect you when you know what the facts are, either by experiencing it, by studying it, you know, and we know what the remedies are. That's another very disturbing thing for me. I know, lots of us know what the remedies are, but it's like, how do we get to the remedies if people in power don't even admit it exists?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. And I think that's a great segment into what our discussion should be, is what are some of the remedies of each of us taking on responsibility of trying to respect human rights. Open the floor up for discussion.
Dr. Brown, I want to piggyback on what Michael said. I don't think there's such thing as racism. It's not exist. I think people just ignore it because they don't want to face it. Because if they agree to it, if they agree that it exists, then a call for a discussion. And it's a matter of not wanting to have that discussion at all, because it is that bad that they don't want to talk about it. I don't think there's such thing as it doesn't exist. Every time I hear somebody trying to even say that, that's a form of just putting it to the side, because it's too painful. It's too ugly. It's too deep-rooted to talk about. I don't think mainly it doesn't exist. How could it not? You know, how could it not when it's in front of us every single day? Even me personally, when I go in to a home, because I do community-based, I sometimes feel like I must explain myself, because the way the person open the door and see me and get shocked at time, I have to sit down and explain, where did I get my training? Where did I get my degree? When did I have it? Just to reassure that person that I am qualified for the job. How could it not exist? And I wondered most of the time, if it was another race on the other side of that door, would he or she have to explain him or herself the way I have, or the way I feel like explaining myself? So it does exist. I think people just refuse to talk about it because it's that bad.
That sounds like denial.
Exactly. Exactly. That's the word. That's the word. And yes, I do feel like it's getting worse than it is getting better. And sometimes things get worse before it gets better. I'm hoping that's the case. But, I, you know, we all hoping that's the case. But it is, I do feel like it is. Ever since I experienced that first encounter at my security job, I don't ever feel like it's getting better. No. I think it's a everyday battle for the color people. I don't think it's one side, because sometimes you have, and this is another aspect we can talk about. We have African Americans or other races who are being, you know, showing racism towards the Caucasians or towards the other group. So it's not always one way. It's two ways. However, I think the racism between African American experiencing it, it's been a long haul for us.
Mm-hmm. You know, I want to piggyback on what you said, Marie and Michael, for those that say that racism doesn't exist, or for communities that won't deal with it because, you know, it's a too much of a hot potato. We have three things that we can do. There's three things that'll happen. One, people will either repress it, and that means that they will push it down and deny it even exists. So that's repression. And then suppress, so we can repress it and say, hey, it doesn't exist. Or we can suppress it when it sticks its ugly head up, we just push it down. Or we can express it and say, we have a problem here. And how are we going to deal with it and open up lines of communication?
Right.
Right. And I do think there are people that are going to do all three, and people that do one or the other are the last one.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It is a painful process. It is a painful process for people who want to work through it. It is a painful process. I do understand that. However, ignoring it or suppress it or repress it every time, it's not going to make any change. It's just sweeping the dirty or the dust under the rug. That does not mean it's disappeared. It's still there.
You know, I have a friend from the Bahamas, and he's educated at St. Andrews in Scotland, which is Oxford, Cambridge, and St. Andrews. It's like the three top schools in the UK. Then he came and did a medical degree at Harvard, or he did medicine in Scotland. Then he went to Harvard for psychiatry, and he taught at Yale. So he got three Ivy League schools, and he's a public speaker, and he's really good. And he gets up, and the first thing he talks about is his skin color. And the guy has incredible credentials. And the first thing he talks about is his skin color. What you say, you feel the pressure, the expectation, people doubt who you are because of your skin color.
Yeah.
And it's like, stop it. I'm like, it's infuriating. And I just, as you were speaking, Marie, I was just thinking about my friend and this is like one of the top people on my list of people who astound me with their credentials and their education and their sophistication. And I mean, he's like the top of my list. And yet he feels the pressure. He's the keynote speaker at some conference. And he feels the pressure to explain his race. And some of it is he's telling his own story about growing up in the Bahamas, but some of it I think is that. But it's astounding. It's astounding to me how deeply rooted that it's not just in the society, but it's in us. We carry it. Whether we're white or black, we carry the expectation. It's been taught to us time after time after time. We've had such disappointing experiences that it's deeply, deeply, it's not just rooted in the society, it's rooted in our own hearts. And even if we're on the wrong end of it, receiving the prejudice against us, it's still so deeply rooted that it's in, as you say, it's in your face. I feel terrible just talking about it.
Right, but going back with what you said, and definitely with what Marie says, it happens to us.
Yeah.
That even though when we're meeting with clients or whatever, they want to know exactly our background, this and that. We have to prove that we have a position at the table.
I don't get that. I mean, maybe when I was younger, I was like 30 when I was a therapist and I looked like I was 20. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really look young for my age. Maybe then they might have asked what my age is, how old are you again?
Right.
Like Doogie Howser, the doctor, like what? Yeah. But I've never had to experience somebody, and I can see specifically if that happens to both the Marie and April, if this happens to you, that people are like, what are your credentials? That's such a, it's offensive. If you get you,
yes.
I mean, it really is offensive. I'm going to say it. I'm offended for you. But I think when they come in and then they say something like that is a very, it's a microaggression.
Right.
I think understanding the stereotypes and microaggressions are a huge part of this. It's not like racism, like somebody's, you know, attacking you per se, but they are attacking you because that's a part of your person and your intellect and your heritage. And so, oh, wow.
Yes, and even, it just even brings me back to last year and with Cape Coral Therapists and me trying to get an office, how I signed up for an office and everything was fine. And they, I didn't show up first. One of my former or other counselors, Kimberly, who's white, showed up, and my husband, who's white, showed up. But when I showed up, it became a problem. And then she said, I don't want your counselors there. I don't want, we can't have this kind of cases here. And so, yes, that's when we first moved to Cape Coral. Yes, and that's when that week I was looking for a place to, you know, have our office and stuff. So it exists.
It does exist. Let me just tell you one thing, because I have another appointment I have to get to. But I moved from Scranton, Pennsylvania, where I had a private practice in Scranton, Pennsylvania. And I moved to South Carolina, and I was in Clemson country. Yes. And it was, I moved to a place called, well, I'll keep the city, you know, anonymous, Pelzer, South Carolina. and so I moved there, and, you know, one, I do not sound like I'm a Southerner, so I already felt different because I am a Yankee, and I was in Pelzer, South Carolina. And so I literally would, I'm an actress, so I'd be like, I change my way I talk and everything, and I wore Jimmy Johnson 48, you know, NASCAR driver to go put my gas, and I changed my dialect and everything. Because I thought, oh my gosh, they're just gonna like string me up for being a Yankee. But then I realized we had a bigger problem in that neighborhood, because when I asked for directions one day, they said, go on down and make a right at the red light, go down to the oak tree and make a left, past the black graveyard. And then, and I went, excuse me, what? Okay, I understand the oak tree and the, you know, stoplight, but what do you mean black graveyard? The black graveyard, And then I realized that they even had different graveyards.
Graveyards, exactly.
And I was like, where the hell am I?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I actually grew up in South Carolina. So
oh, really? So story. you get it.
Yeah.
And I just was like, wow.
I wonder what it's like for people who grew up in Nigeria. We have a lot of Nigerians come to the U.S., a lot of doctors and attorneys and business people, you know, very successful in Nigeria, and they come to and immigrate to the United States as professionals. And I wonder, I've never actually sat down and asked them, they feel prejudiced, that prejudice is against them because they're specifically Nigerian. And they, around the world, the Nigerian prince scam, the email scam. I'm a Nigerian prince and I have $5 million and I need your help to put it in the bank. If you can just put, blah, blah, blah. And they know that there's a national stereotype of the Nigerian scammer. And that's a prejudice that they have to overcome. Not so much because they're black, but because they're Nigerian. On the other hand, in terms of racial prejudice, there's no racial, I don't think there's racial prejudice in Nigeria or in Haiti. If you come to the U.S., what is it like to just to move from one nation to another? What a shock. What is going on here, you know?
And I wanted to mention, because Dr. April, you said before about the remedies, so I wanted to jump back towards the remedies. Public policy and changing the political system, simple, but nearly impossible. Those are the remedies. We can never, you know, changing people's, all individuals' attitudes is impossible, obviously, mm-hmm. but enforcing existing laws and creating laws that make institutional racism at least less prevalent is what needs to happen. The laws are on the books already, most of them, they're just not enforced. And if we follow the timeline of racism in the United States, there are specific benchmarks with where this began in the legal system. Plessy versus Ferguson. When you start saying it's okay and you make it legally okay to keep white and black people separate, but then don't give teeth to separate but equal, right? That's so, yeah, in the history of the US legal system, that's sort of the first case where it was said, okay, it's okay to be separate, but there has to be equality, but there was no teeth behind the law. And then if we see US history go on and on and on, after the Civil War, the South did not give up their systems of slavery for a very long time, many years. Civil rights era, in the 70s, there were still lots of segregated institutions in the US, right? In Florida, schools were still segregated, some of the schools in the early and mid 70s. So we're talking like years after. So I think that that's what like Black Lives Matter and the mainstream of the people that want change, they want to see these things enforced. Right, they're not asking for some special, you know, sort of special treatment, other than the same treatment that everybody else gets.
Right.
Yeah, that's special, right? So whether it's being how police handle pulling somebody over, or neighborhoods that get redlined, right, still happens. That will make a difference, because if your government is not enforcing it, then of course people are going to feel emboldened. We're not going to be able to change every single individual's attitude, right? There's a difference between prejudice and racism, I always tell people, right? Prejudice is those individual judgments, prejudgments. People are going to have those. But something can be done about racism, in other words, the act of enforcing those prejudices on a specific group of people. And that's political and legal change. But that's not that easy to get to.
You know, I have a little difference in my feeling mm-hmm. about this, because this happened in a conversation I was having about race. I've had several conversations about racism in the last couple of months, and where, you know, it's so unsettling, and you know, and I'm like, it occurred to me, so this is just something that just seems true to me, that public policy will never solve it. And because if I change the law, but I hate that person, say I hate that person or I despise that person, I think less of that person, but I follow the law, this anti-racist law, I still have a problem. So do they. Sure. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. Maybe the law prevents them from having a practical problem. But I have a real problem if I still carry disdain and disrespect in my heart.
Absolutely. Right. And so, I mean, you can't legislate people's feelings, it's often said in politics, right?
Right. But that's what I'm saying is because you can't legislate people's feelings.
Right.
I think there's a place for us to appeal to their feelings and to really work on their feelings, because changing the law won't change their disdain.
How do you work on their feelings?
Well, that's the question.
Their heart.
That's what our job is. As counselors, you know, one of our jobs as a counselor is to work on emotions and feelings and underlying beliefs, core beliefs. CBT talks about the ABC. The B in ABC is belief. And it's a heartfelt belief. And our hearts have to change. And even if we change the law and the policy and our hearts still suck, excuse my French, then we have a problem.
Well, like Jeremiah 17:9 says, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it?
Yeah.
I mean, if we really want to get to the root of this, this is a spiritual issue. We are body, we are mind, and we are spirit. And I think that
The issue of denial.
We need to be convicted that it's wrong.
Right.
And some people aren't convicted it's wrong.
Right. Right. When you talked about denial, that is the perfect example of the deceitful heart. The human heart is deceitful above all things. We will even fool ourselves into believing that we don't have racism when we do all day long, and we fool ourselves and push it aside and say it doesn't exist, and we're in denial about our own racism. That's a perfect example of the deceitful heart.
So I'm going to be a little controversial with this group. It wouldn't be controversial in a more political group, but
sure.
I take as a priori that yes, of course, there's no chance that it's ever going to be stamped out. It's not possible. We're talking about stamping out like human reactions to things and things like that. So about solving it, I don't think there's any chance in solving it. There is a chance in enforcing things in a way that make it less prevalent, though. And that's my starting point, right? So yes, we each have clients, but that accounts for 0.00000, you know, I'm gonna keep going with the O's, percent of the population. Yes, I can help my clients be healthier, and that might help them.
Now, I'm not talking about one-on-one counseling. I'm not.
Okay, but as far as, you know, one third of the nation right now, I think it's probably not realistic that I or anyone in this group has the ability to change the hearts and minds of one third the population in the United States. So until that's possible, I want to see laws enforced.
But no. But from when I was a kid, I watched my colleagues at age 14, almost universally racial epithets and disdain for Black people. Unbelievable. I'd never seen it. I had no idea it existed. Didn't know that was out there. And today, if I go back to that town, I can't find five people who think that way. And so it has changed.
And part of why it's changed. Part of the change does occur.
Yeah.
I don't think it's accurate that it doesn't occur because of the policies, because I think part of the reason why it's changed in that town are precisely because of the historical legal unfolding of the United States. In other words, what was once okay
has an influence. It's important.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's not important. I'm just saying that if you change all the laws and people's hearts don't change, we still have a problem. If we change our hearts and the laws don't change, we don't have a problem anymore if our hearts have really changed.
Well, sure. Yeah. And
the goal is heart change. One of the methods is policy. I agree with that.
Yes, we need to have some change in policy.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, so how do you think you change people's hearts? Yes. How do you think you change the nation as a whole, everybody's hearts?
Right. In just a second, with the remedies, for me, I think it starts with each and every one of us. Personally, myself, when I was going to college, when that individual made that comment to me, I was a little bit defensive. I was a little bit feisty. And even after that, I couldn't understand. But now that I have more wisdom, a little bit more wisdom, and understand a little bit more of what's going on, I reacted differently when I go in the home and people looking at me wrong. I just feel like that individual need help. That individual doesn't understand that once the difference, I think the big difference is while we're alive. Once we died, there's no difference. We are just considered as a dead body, and that's all it is to me. So when someone experiencing racism now, for me, is almost as I feel sorry for that person who is behaving that way towards me. And that's where my compassion comes in. Like, okay, this person doesn't understand what he or she is doing, and I prefer not to even answer at this time. You know, depending on the degree. Because if we are talking about we want to do better, we have to actually be the example of that better. I always tell my patient, what is the difference if someone yell at you and you yell back? That puts you in the same basket. But if someone yell at you and you have the courage to say, I don't like that when you yell at me, that person will hear you better than a yell back. So
a scripture verse that says that he that overlooks a matter is as one man winning a war. So, you know, I said, good for you. I'm glad you stood up. But then now that you're older and wiser, or, you know, you're like, hey, you know what? I overlooked that. So you're like one man winning a war.
Yes. And it doesn't mean if someone is walking all over me, I'm just going to sit there and let someone walk all over me. I am going to express myself. But while I'm expressing myself, I'm educating that person that what you are doing is not right. And I am still respecting you because you deserve the respect. I don't approve of it, but you deserve my respect. So going back to the remedies, I think the same Bible verse that says we are to treat others as we like to be treated, that comes in the both end when the person is treating us correctly or incorrectly. We are still to be respectful of that person. And being respectful, it's not always easy. It's easier to go the same route as that person. Let's say someone is being disrespectful. It doesn't take any courage to be disrespectful back, but it takes tons of courage to be respectful in the midst of someone being disrespectful. That's my approach. Mm-hmm. On top of the law that needs to be changed and all the policies that need to be improved, I think it's us has to kind of rise up in a much more positive way while we are enforcing. For example, I'll put in a little bit more light, much more light to end it for me, is I don't mind protesting, but I do mind, you know, breaking into Target, breaking into Walmart and stealing things. So it's like, okay, yes, I'm going to voice myself. I'm going to say what's not right. But in the meanwhile, I'm not causing much trouble in that situation. And I'm not going to be as worse as the way that person just treated me.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I was
You have a wisdom of experience. Talk.
Yes. Okay. No, I definitely agree with Michael that policy change needs to happen. Yeah. And I think with policy change that creates awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And when more people are aware of things, sometimes that will change hearts a little. Maybe not a lot, but maybe change behaviors. Yeah. And sometimes with behaviors, heart change.
Yeah.
But policy does need to happen. And I love what Marie says, because we're talking about respecting human rights. So when someone is disrespectful, we need to be respectful back, because that shows them something different. because for some people, I even counseled a person who was completely racist and hated Black people and stuff. He had never been around a Black person who treated him normal, basically. He had been abused by some Black guys. So I agree with what Marie says. When it happens to us, we have to give back respect. And that's very important, even in the sense of the protest. So yes, I do know that we have another therapist that just joined us, Raina Verlach. Raina, do you want to introduce yourself?
She's muted.
Oh, did I take her off mute? I can unmute.
Raina.
I can't unmute her. Okay, there she goes. There you go. All right. Yes, Raina, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. My name's Raina Verlach, and I'm a counselor here in Destin, Florida. I've known Dr. Brown for about 10 years, and I'm really happy to be with you all. So there are some other familiar faces, David and Kelly, and you know, I'm looking forward to getting to know the rest of the gang.
So. Okay. All right. Do you have any, we were talking about different ways to move past this, in the sense of healing, mental health, wellness, and coming up with remedies?
Well, I think grace is a choice, and it's not an easy choice to make. They were talking about being respectful to those who are disrespectful. And I heard somebody talking about scriptures and whatnot, but I really believe that grace is a choice, and it can be a pretty difficult choice to make because it costs quite a bit. And you know, one, just having good common sense, finding out what the meaning of equanimity and equality is, and just choosing grace and realizing that it's not an easy choice to make when people are, you know, puffed up or disrespectful or come at you in a not so nice way. Just grace is a difficult choice to make, but it goes a very, very long way. That, and I feel like a lot of people are expecting negative when they see, you know, diverse faces.
Oh, did we might have lost her.
We're losing your, you're muted again.
Yes, you're muted again.
You're still muted.
Right. Oh, okay.
There we go.
So just expect, thank you so much. Pardon me for that. So just expect good in diverse spaces. Don't expect badness. Don't listen to what the programming is. Expect that people are going to be good. Expect people are going to be kind. And if they're not, because they're struggling, choose grace and understand it's not always an easy choice. And that's very common sense, but that's what I've got.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. That's very powerful. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, to expect the good out of people. Yes, because it's all about connecting. And sometimes mm-hmm. when we're around people that are different from us, if we don't expect good, we put up a wall and we live in our stereotypes.
What a shame.
To me, it's about labeling, and labeling happens. The thing about race is that it's the first thing you see. It's visible, you know? If I say I'm a Republican, some people are going to have a reaction because I said that. If I say I'm a Democrat or I'm a progressive, other people will have a reaction to that. If I say I'm Buddhist, some people will have a reaction. Those things aren't visible. If I show up with a MAGA hat or if I show up with an Obama sticker on my textbook or something, you know,
Yeah. People
are going to react to that because it's visible. They see it. And they automatically assume things. And I think that's, to me, that's damaging across the culture totally. To make a decision based on somebody's approach, their labels, how they identify. I look for little signs. I used to look for little signs of, okay, where are they coming from? And I'm like, no, stop it. Just listen and be real, you know?
So that idea that our physical differences like mean something that they don't mean is what you're saying.
Yeah, but it doesn't, then we also do that with politics and religion, parts of the country, regionalism,
nationality. Mm-hmm. But does it make you safer?
No, and it robs you. What you said about expecting good from people, and stop letting these labels get in your way. It's like a screen. It's like you're keeping things out that are good things, and you're the one carrying the screen.
So in a way, it's worse for the people. There's certain things that are worse for the people that actually practice it because of,
Mm-hmm. So Marie, what I get from Marie is just, what I keep hearing from Marie is courage and compassion.
Absolutely.
And Raina's grace.
And Raina says it takes courage to be compassionate and give grace.
I'm saying, good. I'm glad you stood up for yourself.
Well, back then, yes. Because I am, it is in me to be feisty anyway and to fire back. As soon as somebody fire at me, I was already ready to fight back. But now I still fight, but it's how I fight. Yeah. I think I changed my strategy on how I fight so that person, I can still win while I'm educating that person. Because sometimes it may look like I'm losing a battle, but in the other end, I am winning because I'm not letting that person take me to a place where I don't want to go.
You're activating a label for me. You know what I hear in from you? Haiti, the Haitian, I'm here. You're going to listen, right?
Think of it like this, you guys.
Exactly.
This is like a rope. Have you ever played tug of war? I was a part of Awana when I grew up. I can still sing the Awana theme song from my youth group.
What's Awana?
It's a youth group. It's it's usually in churches. It stands for, I forgot what it stood for, but I can sing the theme song, but I don't think you want me to. But we played tug of war. And so if you think about tug of war, when somebody is pulling, maybe you did it at a family reunion and there's a big puddle of mud in the middle and whoever gets pulled into it. But remember that if you drop the rope, what happens? Mm. You stop the struggle and you're not the one that falls. So you decide at any point in an argument or in these highly escalating situations, you know what? It's not working. They're pulling. I'm pulling. I'm going to drop the rope and I'm going to release this. Then that's the best thing to do. And having the wisdom of not drop the rope. Because some people just will not change. These are deeply rooted things that were passed along to them, many of them from their children, their childhood, or they themselves are hurting and they just want to hurt others.
So you don't feel that some of it can change, or do you feel?
I do believe it can change. I think that if we have policies in place, that it will protect people. It's about protecting people. Those policies are like boundaries. Yes. And boundaries are good and they're not evil. Yes. I love my fire in the fireplace, not in the middle of my living room. So boundaries are good and not evil. Policies are good if they're really thought through. But I really think that only God can change someone's heart. And these are deep, some of them, these are deep rooted issues of hatred. Mm-hmm. And hate is the opposite of love. And God is love. And so God can, I think that he can change a heart.
Yes. And each of us have God inside of us.
Yes.
And so, yes.
Yeah. Yes. I think, rethinking the policy, public policy issue, absolutely, you have to have policies to prevent harm, personal harm or institutional harm. Absolutely. I'm not against that. I'm just saying, people, when you see people change, people tell story after story of my wife's family from the late 1800s had a photograph of a black couple. And then my wife's white. And here's a, people walk in the house and say, what are you doing with this portrait of a black couple on your piano or on your living room wall? Say, well, that's the family that saved grandpa's life. And you know, my dad had a KKK burned a cross on his dad's front lawn. They're white people, but they had a KKK cross burned on their lawn. And, you know, it's not, you know, we are not so untouched by hatred and racism just because we're white. You know, we're, you know, that's another thing that I don't think ever gets said. I've never heard it said, you know.
For people who are naturally empathetic like you and other, you know, it's gonna hurt, right? It's gonna hurt. I'm sure you feel it. Like, well, you said,
I remember watching George Floyd die.
Yeah.
I'll never forget that.
Yeah.
I can see why we're in the mess we're in, because that can't be, that's awful.
And you wonder, like, say me and you are watching it, you wonder how other people could watch it and not feel the same, right? It's like, how can you watch that happening and not feel what we're talking about, what you're talking about?
I have an answer to that. It goes to the tug of war. And the tug of war is everyone, I think everyone, is naturally, I haven't met anybody who's not compassionate and empathetic and horrified by what happened to George Floyd. I mean, I haven't met anybody.
I could introduce you to some.
I kind of doubt it, because I think you may read that into people.
Well, they say it out. Oh, sorry. Yeah, sorry.
Well, let me finish. So the tug of war, we get pushed into a position because somebody else says, you must do this, this, and this. And we go, yes, we must do this. But we don't have to do this, and this. In fact, this, and this is harmful. Burning down Wendy's is terrible. And somebody else says, no, you have to do that. So people who are against the violence and the destruction are categorized as not being sympathetic to George Floyd, and they're dying for George Floyd. They're in heart, they're grieving what happened to him. I am. But I'm still against burning down buildings. Uh-huh. So somebody comes and says, you've got to burn down buildings. And I've been in movements that believe that. I used to march against the war in Vietnam. I used to hurl epithets at conservatives. I used to, you know, believe in bombing, you know, the U.S. Post Office or whatever. I didn't believe in that, but I was
close. Are there any pictures of you protesting?
I'll show you a picture later. I slept overnight in this SDS headquarters, Students for Democratic while they were having a Weatherman conference. Uh-huh. You know, and so, you know, people make assumptions because you don't agree with me on these two things, you must be automatically in this other camp. That's prejudice.
Do you feel that people sometimes lump you into that?
All the time.
Yeah.
Well, I've always been glad I'm not a white man.
Hold on.
Yeah.
What is this movement about? Is it about people seeing white people the wrong way, or is it about something else?
Well, it's about racism. It's about racism against blacks. That's clearly what it's about.
Clearly, yeah.
Absolutely about racism against blacks. That is the primary problem. No question.
Yeah, David, just like I think Michael was saying, you're very empathetic. But there are some people who are not empathetic. They can see George Floyd, and I shouldn't have used the word, but they cannot put themselves there.
I'm not denying that people, there are people out there who have a terrible attitude about this. No question about it. But they're still not for the murder of George Floyd. They're still against police brutality.
There's a lot of people out there. I was going to say, there's a lot of people out there that are perfectly happy about what happened and totally blame George Floyd.
Really?
In other words, in the United States in general? Well, yeah.
Yes.
Sure.
Yeah.
Blame George Floyd?
Look at and jump on the Facebook page of any newspaper in the country, and you're going to find thousands of posts. And interviews too, of he shouldn't have done it. He should have just, you know, submitted and it wouldn't have happened. And
Wow, I read a lot. I haven't seen that. I
read not from people like you and like us.
I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I'm just saying I haven't seen it.
Not from people like us, but the average American, or you know.
No,
I read
conservative stuff all the time. I'm a conservative. Right. I've listened to almost nothing but conservative stuff, and I haven't heard that expressed once anywhere. Now, I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I'm just saying I haven't, in all the conservative reading and listening I've done, I haven't heard it expressed anywhere.
I have to go to another appointment. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, that's okay. We're
spending time with you. I remembered that Awana is approved workmen are not.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
So that's interesting. I'm interested in what and your experience with that, because well, that's terrible if that's happening. I'd like to be educated on that. So,
and you must have heard people saying, like, if you just do what the cops say, you'll be fine, right? You've heard that, I'm sure.
I've also been beaten by the cops.
Right, but I'm saying those are the people that are saying they're saying just do, and I'm trying to think, I've even seen it on interviews and shows in the last couple of days, like, if you just submit, you'll be fine. And it's because he didn't do what they said.
Well, he did do what he said. Oh, well, right. He had a little problem with claustrophobia, to say the least. But
that's what people are out there are saying, that it you brought it on yourself, and if he just, you know, if we just do what the police say, we'll be fine. Right, that whole sort of mentality that's out there with, you know, like I say, if you just stop an average person, like, most people are going to say that, I think, that they agree with that.
I haven't seen it once.
I want to comment on that, since we're talking about remedies and respecting others, no matter, well, I don't want to say no matter what, but showing respect. I want to say, you know, it doesn't matter if someone is not doing as the cop said. There's procedures in place if someone is not doing what the cop said.
This goes to policy.
But those procedures does not involve someone putting their knees on somebody's neck until they died. Mm-hmm. And that's why I ended it. I'm hearing people said, well, maybe the police officer felt like his life was in danger. There's a procedure for that. Yeah. If someone pull their guns on a police officer, there's a procedure for that. And on that scene, there's no gun involved when it comes to George Floyd.
Yeah. So I haven't heard a single person justify. Not a single.
Let me make it a little bit more interested for you. I even hear young African-American young lady who is talking about how it is George Floyd's fault, how it never happened. Mm. There you have it.
Yes. So it goes back again to, I guess, what Michael was saying, it's policy.
Yes. I think policies will play a big role. That's a big remedy.
But policy is... The guys got fired, and they got what they got because they broke policy. Policy was in place that you can't do what they did. That policy was already there. They broke their own policy.
Let me flip the coin for you. If it was an African police officer, police officer who had put his knees on a white Caucasian male till death, what would the result be?
Very different.
Very different.
Well, I think it'd be different because whites
look at the whole picture and say something is wrong with it.
I have not heard one single public voice. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe there are crazy people out there who don't make sense. I get that. There's always, I think this, well, I have not heard not one single conservative, and I listen to conservatives all the time because I am one. I have not heard not one single conservative person say or intimate, even suggest that George Floyd did anything wrong or that he deserved what he got. I mean, that's just, if it's the impression that you have, that conservatives think that, I have not seen or heard a single person over all these months even suggest that.
Yeah, it's not about conservative. I'm sorry, go ahead. I was going to say it's not about conservative. I didn't say I heard conservative say it.
Yeah.
And I don't know anything about your politics or, but are there people, lots of people out there that believe that and say that? Well, sure. I don't know if they're conservatives. It doesn't have anything to do with political ideology, but there are lots of people out there who will say that if you don't want to be bothered by the police.
Well, I get that. People might say that, and but it's not true. I've been beaten by the police.
No, we know it's not true, but what do we do about that? What do we do about that?
Yeah, right. And I think in the end, we just need to really respect every person's life.
Human in other words, how do we get police to stop, or police and society in general, to stop saying that Black people should start behaving better, right? So it's victim blaming, right? We know that people do that. They victim blame.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you say that they have to behave better and wear their clothes differently and wear their hair differently, right? So that they don't get stopped in the first place. That's what I hear. I don't know, have any idea what the people's political ideology is that are saying those things, but I mean, it's out there and we've heard it and we've probably thought of it ourselves. Well, geez, that person deserved it, or they should have been more gracious with the police, right? So it's like, what do we do about that?
Yeah, and I come back to say, to join with you, it comes back to the policies. There are policies for stopping someone. There's policies for why you should stop someone. It's the policies. You cannot tell me you stop someone or they call you for someone, the next thing, your knees on somebody's neck until death. It makes no sense. Which policy is that?
It has to be, I guess going with what you're saying, Marie, there has to be policy for when you break procedures.
Sure.
But David, policies, if someone,
but the policy, there is no policy that you put your knee on a guy's neck till he dies.
So,
policy doesn't exist. So the problem is that there are people who break policy. So
and there needs to be policy for those people who break the policy.
Right, and the policy was to fire him and charge him with murder. That's the policy, and that policy is happening. But it's not. Sorry.
Go ahead. I'll wait after you.
So the policy is that you fire him the minute he does it. You charge him with murder. You take him to trial, you put him in prison, whatever you do. And I think he should get first. I think it's a mistake to charge him with second degree murder. I think that was first degree murder. I think he intended, after he was on the guy's neck for that many minutes, and so many people said so many times that you're killing him.
Right.
And the guy said, I can't breathe 28 times or 68 times, whatever it was. And the guy continued to ignore it. And I saw this from a conservative, and she said, the judge, and she says, every moment that he was told you're going to kill him, and he refused to check the guy or do anything different, was a moment when he was actually making the decision to kill him. And that's intentional first degree murder. And that's from a judge who's tried murder cases. And I think it is first degree murder. And so I think the guy should get either capital punishment or life in prison. So there is no, that's where policy doesn't solve it. Because the policy is you can't do that. And the policy is you get charged with murder, go to prison for the rest of your life. That's the policy.
What if there was a policy that there's citizen oversight committees that different training?
Well, the thing is, the policy failure is that he had done things like this.
That's right.
And he had been let go and
excused. That's right.
And that there was not adequate mental health screening in place to make sure people like this don't get a badge.
Yeah.
To me, that was a policy failure.
I think the million-dollar question is, what if there was not a video? What if there was this? Mm-hmm. What if, what would have happened? Nothing.
Nothing at all.
That's what we are talking about, racism.
If there was no video, documenting this,
and
the million other cases that happen every single day to people of color, that it would just be laughed at, if even laughed at. And that's the problem. Again, unequal treatment of an entire group of citizens, right?
And the million-dollar question, again, is how many of us that died that way just for the lack, with no justice, because we had no videos?
Yes.
We had no witness.
Yes.
Mandatory, you know, I'm all for mandatory, what do you call it, that the cameras automatically go on.
Body cams.
Yeah, body cams. Thank you. Yeah. I'm all for mandatory body cams, but that's not a thing either.
Yeah. There's a murder of another black man, and the dash cam's missing. No body cam, no dash cam.
Oh, my God.
Guy in Georgia, not Georgia, where was that? It's another incident of police murder.
And the video is missing?
Yeah, both the body cam and the dash cam. Jeez.
Yeah, it's terrible.
We're not talking about respecting.
Right. It's definitely no respect there in the sense of what's going on. And as we're wrapping up this conversation,
Raina,
what are you guys' last thoughts on remedy? I know we've talked about policy and we talked about hearts changes and we talked about grace. Raina, what are your last thoughts on these? As we hear the cop.
Well,
that's me. That's by me. Yeah.
Oh, that's yours. Okay.
I guess my main question is, what can we do to make services more accessible to people of color and people who are in law enforcement and first responders, people who are in positions of authority, regardless of their identity? So I think it's about making services more accessible across the board. So once that conversation opens and once you get the call or someone is saying, hey, I'm thinking that maybe I need to talk to someone, how can we formulate the words coming out of our mouth and our attitude and our heart and our perspective that is respectful and welcoming and sends a clear message that we're there for them and their healing and their journey?
Absolutely.
So it's just a question, really. I mean,
it's a good question.
I have some ideas, but that's, I just want to know how to make those services more accessible when somebody finally does actually reach out, because it takes a lot for a person to ask to get our services.
And I think you're onto something, because I think that would have an effect if more sort of groups, right, counseling centers, groups, because that's aligning with that group of people. In other words, right, we're saying outright that we're supporting. Yeah, sorry.
It should be equal between, are we tailoring our services and are we tailoring our outreach efforts for law enforcement, first responders, and people who are of color who have been victims of racism and possibly brutality or violence. So just equally, it's not one side or the other. It's how are we best making it clear that we're an advocate for all humans' rights?
Yeah. I think the focus has to be on the people that are experiencing the oppression in this category, not in general, but in this category, because there is difference. And, you know, it's back to the, like, all lives matter, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, a certain group is being oppressed. So if we say that, if we don't focus on the oppression of that group, it's difficult to help that group.
100%.
Yeah.
Yes, I do think, I agree with you, Michael, that it right now, and, you know, as counselors, we can take care of everybody who comes to us, meaning provide services. But I think it's based on what they bring to us. For example, if a white Caucasian come talking about he or she may be racist and need help, I'm going to have a different approach as opposed to a African-American come saying, I've been a victim of racism. I'm going to have a different approach. I don't think in counseling there's one best fits all. I think it's based on what the person brings to us.
Mm-hmm.
We have theories and we have a base, but it's never gonna be one size fits all. And also too, I do think all lives matter. I'm going to use one explanation somebody's daughter doing supervision had explained. Yes, all lives matters. But right now, the example that young lady took is if you're walking down the road and on the neighborhood and somebody's house is on fire, but the next house is not, and it's perfectly fine, the winkler's going, watering the plants, the beautiful flowers, and next door, there's a fire. When, let's say the firefighters arrive, which house do you think they're going to walk to? You think they're going to walk? I mean, it makes total sense. And I think she's 13 or 14. Do you think they're going to run to the person's home who the sprinklers, watering the beautiful flowers? Or do you think the firefighter men are going towards the house that actually on fire? This is what's going on right now. The Black populations, the minorities are on fire, and we need help. And we need help right now. That other house, yes, all lives matters. All houses matter. Mm-hmm. But that next door house need of my attention, as opposed to the one on fire.
I'm giving you a high five in the air.
You're here.
And this is not my quote. I get this in supervision from somebody else's daughter.
I wonder.
If someone said all lives matters, yes. But right now, we mm-hmm. the African American are in trouble right now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I do think extra services and marketing to help them, to help us and to help Black people and people of color get help through mental health services. But I also agree with Raina that sometimes racism can be healed through mental health. That sometimes those people have issues and maybe talking mm-hmm. with someone, working through their trauma or whatever, mm-hmm. hearts can change, which is what David is talking about in the sense of us overcoming all this, because the hearts have to change.
I have a policy suggestion. I think, you know, those who are in trouble and hurting and feeling oppressed may come forward for help. And I think more help has to be offered, according to what Marie said. You know, Black folks need support and help from us right now. And I agree. Here's the thing, here's the policy change. I think something, the cop who has no regard for somebody either because they're a criminal, because they're Black, because they're poor, because they're on the wrong side of the track. This cop, I believe this cop is just as mean. He may not have killed a white guy. I think that a white man he would not have killed, but I bet he would have mistreated. I think he's a mean cop. I think he's an evil man. And that guy will never show up for counseling. And I think the policy change is you've got to identify these people, and you have to offer that if they don't go for help and work through their stuff, they get out of here. And that didn't happen.
No, I think that's a good point, David. And you know, think about it. Think about our profession. Like, to get a job in a college, and I've worked in colleges, like, you have to go through a lot of hoops. And just to get our licenses, right. We're getting freaking fingerprinted and lie detector tested. I'm being facetious, but we go through a lot of hoops, and so do a lot of other professions. But then you have this profession that holds this power, right? Police, and this, you know, potentially destructive, like you're saying, and they don't seem to have to do even the basic amount of things to demonstrate mental stability or anything like that. So I think that's a good idea.
And even when red flags came up for this guy a couple of times and they didn't follow up, they didn't do what they have to do.
Yes. So David, what are your final words on this?
That was it.
Okay, awesome.
We need new policy. We need new politics and policy.
All right. Marie, as we're wrapping this up, do you have any final words?
I think I already said it, but respecting ourselves and respecting when somebody else are in need of help. When we are not here to deny, we are not here to take side. We are one human race, and it is about time that we showed that. You know, it is about time. It's been a long time coming, and we still have a long way to go. Respecting exactly. ourselves, it's number one. If we're yes. not respecting ourselves, we cannot respect others. We cannot give what we don't have.
Yes, definitely. Thank you guys so much for being on the panel. I know Michael's must have gone, but I agree with all the things that you guys have been talking about. And I want to end with the quote of Maya Angelou, because basically for things to happen and to change, it's about us making connections, getting to know different people, different races, and understanding one another. So one of Maya Angelou's favorite quotes was, "I've learned that people will forget what you said, people forget what you did, but people will never forget how you make them feel." And as therapists out there that we're working with clients and stuff, it's how we make each other feel. And so I would like to thank you guys so much. This has been amazing. And God bless you guys all, and keep safe, especially in this time of period of COVID that we're in also. All right. God bless you guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.